Today is the fifth in the Moral Issues in Medicine series, and today we're going to talk about organ transplantation. Probably be some other issues that will come to bear, especially on this, but this is what the title is of it. The way we usually work these is I talk for a few minutes, kind of lay out the problem and talk about some of the issues, and then we throw it open for discussion and all put our two cents worth in about it. In 1951, Dr. David Hume in Boston performed the first real organ transplant of a cadaver kidney to a sick patient and started this whole, shall we say, controversy. His patient only lived about 6 months after it was transplanted, but it proved that it was feasible, and very shortly, within a year after that, several patients further received transplants, and they lived up to 2 years, and so the whole transplant era was then started. We're still, when we're talking about organ transplantation, still talking primarily about kidney transplants, because kidney transplants have been the most successful transplants. We've gone through the heart and the liver and perhaps a few other organs, but none of them have panned out and been nearly as successful as the kidney transplant. And this is what I think should call a high technology treatment program. It's estimated that in the United States today approximately 100,000 people die every year with kidney-related diseases. We're talking about a major number of people who die from diseases that we can do something about in terms of this particular organ for transplantation. Of that 100,000 who die, probably at least 10,000 of them, and perhaps more of them, could be saved if we had organs to transplant to them. At the present time, there's only a little over 1,000 transplants done a year of actual kidneys, and the great majority of these are what we call cadaver kidneys, kidneys who are taken from a non-related person who's been pronounced dead, and the kidneys have been harvested. A very small percentage of the transplants come from living donors. Usually these are related people. And this is perhaps one of the areas where we can talk about controversy, and this involves the controversy of informed consent. And mainly we're talking about in the case of, say, twin children, where one child gives a kidney to the other child, who can really make the decision? Does the parent have the, should the parent be the primary figure that makes that decision that will allow one twin to undergo this surgery and give up one of their kidneys to the other one so that the other one may live? And this has been somewhat controversial. Mainly in legal circles, because it's felt that the child does not have the mental capacity to really understand the full issues of what they're giving up to the other child so that the other one may live. There also is the problem of family pressure. One study which was done not too long ago of donors, living donors, who gave kidneys, it was felt after these people were talked to after they had given up the kidney that 40% of them, if there had not been a lot of family pressure, probably would not have donated their organ. And so this is even though it's common practice now when a doctor is interviewing a person who is considered a potential donor, he tells them that if they feel that there's a great deal of family pressure, and they can't handle it and want it out, that he will tell the family that their tissue match is so poor that they are not a candidate to give that organ. And so this is a common, or this is a routine procedure right now. And any donor, if they are able to make that kind of a consent, that we stress upon them the fact that we want them to be doing it freely of their own will and not because of family pressure. This is only a minor number of people, however, when you compare those cadaver donors. Now, I said that there were about 1,000 transplants done per year, and the major portion of these came from cadavers. There's a need, however, for at least 9 to 14,000 more just in the, say, in the area of kidneys for transplantation. And the question is, how should we get these kidneys? How should they be made available? Congress passed the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, which was hopefully going to stimulate more people to will or give their organs. A poll done in 1968 by Gallup showed that over 70% of people were willing to, at least in this poll, just to give their organs at the time of their death if they would help someone else. Here in our own state, you may, if you live in Washington, this last year we were all sent a, when with our driver's license renewal, we were sent a little card that said if you would be interested in donating your organ, if you would sign this card, which I thought was really quite a neat way of doing it. And I talked to a number of people, and they thought so also. I sent my card back in with my driver's license renewal money and everything, and back came the card. And my understanding was, I thought they were going to, when they cover your driver's license with plastic, that this would be on the back of it. But apparently somebody hadn't thought that through far enough, and they sent back just this little slip of paper and with your signature on it. And I was really disappointed in that, because I was going to look through my wallet and see if I'm still carrying that right now. I'll bet I can't find it. And I think most of us, probably after we've gotten the card back in the mail, will lose it somewhere. And so it won't be available at the time when you are involved in an accident, or if you die, or if you're in a situation where your organs would be available. So I'm disappointed, and I'm hoping that the next few years that they will remedy that situation and make it actually a physical part of your driver's license. It'll be embossed in the plastic and be right on there, and I hope that that's going to take place. Even though the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act has been passed, we've not been deluged with a lot of organs. And there are presently recommendations making it that it will be, the recommendations are that unless the family objects, or unless you specifically had objected in writing, then your organs would automatically be made available for transplantation or use after a death. This is presently used in countries like Israel, Sweden, and France. And it's felt that if this procedure were in use in the United States right now, we'd easily have 15 to 20,000 kidneys per year available from people who sustain severe neurologic damage, and their organs then would be available for transplantation. And we would have more than enough organs for use, and at least for kidney transplantation. So that's one of the proposals for the future, and you may be involved in communicating with people about that. Now, there's some problems that relates to the cadaver donor. First of all, as we talked about a little bit yesterday, when is the cadaver dead? Is it when there is no longer heart function and lung function? Is it when there is no longer any brain function and the EEG is perfectly flat? This is a critical decision in terms of organ transplantation, because if you wait until too late, the organ which we're trying to save and use for somebody else will deteriorate, and it will not be a usable organ. And so this raises the whole issue of who makes the determination of when the patient is dead, and also how should the patient who is dying be treated during those last few hours of their life, because how they're treated can really determine whether that organ will be usable or not. Right now, it's common practice in areas of the country where transplantation is done on a fairly routine basis to have doctors who are not actively involved in the treatment of the patient, a team of doctors who determines when the patient is dead. And we have another team of doctors over here who are concerned with the actual care of the patient up till the time that they die. And there's supposed to be no real communication between them, and we're not supposed to get involved with prolonging the suffering, say, of the dying individual so that his organ will be a better transplantable organ. This is a real problem, because many times when the doctor is faced with a dying patient, we withhold treatment such as fluids, intravenous fluids, intravenous nutrition to hasten the death process and thereby cut down on the suffering. And if you deplete the body far enough of fluids, then the kidneys begin their deterioration process. They can actually shut down 24, 36, 72 hours before the patient actually dies, and those organs then are deteriorating during that whole period of time. So this is a very fine line that we're treading at this particular point in deciding when is the patient physically dead, how should he be treated during that last period of time, so that we're not prolonging his suffering, but still are going to end up with anatomic or with usable organs if he has he or his relatives have agreed that his organs can be transplanted. Another big question that Mary Schramm has raised a couple times during these sessions is the costliness of this technology. We're talking for a kidney transplant right now, and I'm talking about just the kidney transplant procedure itself. We're talking of a medical care cost of around $35,000 probably in today's cost. And you've got to realize that there was a lot of expensive procedures that went on before a patient ever came to the stage of consideration for kidney transplant. There was a lot of renal dialysis, which is very costly and costs over $100,000 a year easily in some kidney failure patients, just for renal dialysis. How are we going to use medical resources which right now are limited? The cost of one kidney transplant could be used to feed 100 children who are suffering from malnutrition and restore their health. It could be used to screen 5,000 people in a genetic clinic or in genetic areas for discovering PKU and other diseases that of infants. It could be used for 20,000 to immunize 20,000 people against polio, or to do for DPT or measles, mumps, rubella, and all of these things. So as we're talking about medical resources become scarcer and scarcer, the whole issue of how much money should be committed to one highly technologically sophisticated procedure, how much should be given to just that. Congress in 1972, in their great wisdom, thought they were going to take care of all the kidney transplants in the United States by appropriating $1 billion, which seemed like an astronomical amount of money. That was going to set up kidney dialysis centers all over the United States. It was going to foster the development of home dialysis, and was going to also take care of a lot of these people who needed kidney transplants. They found out that that just really started the ball rolling, and I don't know how many billion dollars we're committing now per year to this very expensive program. And it really is expensive. If we want to totally take care of all the kidney patients in the United States, it's going to be billions and billions and billions of dollars. The last thing I wanted to raise in the discussion, because there are a limited number of kidneys available for transplant, how should we make the decision who gets the transplant and who doesn't? Because there are lots of people out there who want that kidney, everyone that becomes available. Not all of them are candidates for them. We have to, at this particular time, try to find a donor and a person who will receive it that have a relatively good tissue match so that we don't get a rejection of the organ after a very short period of time. But still, we have a lot of candidates for each kidney that becomes available. Right now, the two proposals are random selection and selection by social utility. And here in the state of Washington, we've had a controversy because we chose the latter one, which is what most states do, the selection by social utility. And we had a committee since most of our transplantation, or all of our transplantation, is done in the Seattle area. It was made up of citizens of Seattle, I'm sure ministers and doctors and housewives and such, and they were to carefully screen the possible people who would receive kidneys and make the decision on who should receive a kidney and who should live and who should die. Basically, it boils down to, in a lot of cases, after they had been functioning for a number of years, study was done of the selection process, and it had a tremendous amount of bad publicity because it turned out that basically people who were wealthy and people who were very influential had the first choice at all of the kidneys that became available. And I think that now we probably are on a random selection basis. But I think that that also has its problems. I was involved a year ago in a case which really bothered me at the time. A young man of about 25 or 30 was admitted in kidney failure. He was a drug addict who had shot his kidneys through use of drugs. He was a pimp. He kept a stable of women. And he openly boasted to us about the fact that his girls made him at least $800 or more dollars per week, and also supplied him with all of his drug needs. He took a lot of dialysis and care to clean up his bloodstream and get all the impurities out, which is the main function of the kidneys, and restore him to his health. During that whole period of time that he was in the hospital, we were, because we suspected with the people coming and going from his room he was still using drugs, we were screening his urine routinely and documenting the fact that he was continuing to use drugs all during the time that he was in the hospital and we were taking care of him. He was recommended for kidney transplant, not by myself, he was really recommended over my objections, but by one of the other doctors, or one of the renal specialists on the team, and actually was accepted into the program. And as far as I know, he was transferred, last I knew of him, to the University of Washington for kidney transplant. And I really felt bad about that, felt very frustrated about it. But as a physician, I have learned to accept these things as a part of society. It's not my job to make these decisions. I can make recommendations, and I felt that my recommendation that he not be considered because of the fact that he continued to abuse drugs during the whole treatment program was the way I felt about it. And I felt that the very good likelihood was that he would continue to use drugs even after he got his kidney transplant, and would blow that kidney in a very short period of time also. So that's the end of my tale and posed a lot of questions, and now let's throw the thing out and let you discuss it.
In the book Dune Science Fiction, the one community of people had a water scarcity, and they had this philosophy that the water belonged to the tribe or the community. And when an individual died, they had a process that just zapped all the fluid out of the body and went into the reservoir that was for sustaining the life of the people. They thought his body belonged to him, but his water belonged to the community. Now that sense of community, and maybe even our own organs, you know, belong to the living community. And I don't know if we could eventually come to that kind of a thing, but it always presents the possibility that with our death as a standard routine kind of thing, our vital organs that we may have just go into a bank or something. Mm-hmm. But it would certainly take a lot of mentality changing in terms of the way we treat bodies now.
Mm-hmm. I think when you mentioned about the country Israel, Sweden, and France, that do this automatically, I think you're dealing with certain types of faith. If I understand, the Catholic faith has some strong feelings.
Objection. Primarily objection towards.
Right. And Sweden, of course, is primarily Lutheran. Israel is Jewish, of course. And France is literally, you know, virtually unchurched. Or, you know, the people are, you know, very church floor. So I think that really we have a large Catholic population in our country. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones that we have to deal with.
I'm wondering what kind of deaths make organs unsuitable for transplant? Are it severe accidents, or what sort of things, especially with kidneys, makes them unacceptable?
The patient that is the best candidate for organ retrieval is a patient who has had a neurologic death. In other words, they've had a severe head injury with the rest of their body relatively intact. And it's estimated that in the United States there are at least 15 to 20,000 people who die this kind of death every year that have a lot of organs that are recoverable for other people's use.
Does age have much to do with it, for example? Kidneys?
Oh, yes, it does, yeah. And a lot of these people are younger, are the younger people. These are the people who are riding motorcycles without their helmets on and these kind of things.
How soon after death must the organ be, I don't like to say harvested, but taken?
Within a very few minutes after death.
Very few minutes.
Mm-hmm. That's why it's a very critical situation. The decision has got to be made that this person is terminal and that they have an injury that's severe enough that they will not survive. And we've got to find out that they are a candidate for giving the organs. Right now, relatives can give permission for the harvesting of organs if they have not signed a document to allow it on themselves beforehand. And then you've got to form a group of doctors who will care for that patient up till the time of death. And then you have to have your transplant team who is ready to harvest the organ.
And when you transplant, do you have your donor, let's say, on one table and is it that quick?
No, the scientists who are really into this thing envision a day when we will, when a patient comes in like this, we will automatically do a tissue typing, which will go into a computer and will match that individual with possible recipients all across the United States, and they'll decide where the best tissue match is. They'll harvest the organ, put it on a jet plane, fly it to wherever that person is, transplant it into his body as soon as it arrives there.
Within hours,
yes. And this is presently done now for a lot of these.
The moral complication of this whole thing clicks just as you thought. You know, you have to have deaths in order to have organs. And it's best if you have brain damage death. So I need a kidney, and I pick up my paper in the morning looking for the death by accident. Mm-hmm. I'm excited about a person who gets killed by And I repeal the law on helmets for motorcycle riders because of the breeder. Man, doesn't it get all screwed up?
Yeah, they're in the actual book that I was using here was a story of a young couple who had done just exactly this. They went to the point where they rented an apartment right across from the hospital so that they would be available at 24 hours notice to receive the kidney. And they talked about how they felt every time they heard the siren. And they decided after living for a period of time across from the hospital that they were turning into ghouls and you know, all of the implications with that.
Does a relative have the legal right to release organs from a person that's terminal?
Mm-hmm. They do.
Is there a legal complication with this then?
No, I don't think so, because number one, we're talking about a national passed law, and I think all the legal parameters have been tested by now, and that is pretty well the law of the land.
Even though the person may have several days or perhaps a week more to live,
mm-hmm.
but if they were allowed to continue naturally, the organs would be, or some of them would be no longer usable.
Mm-hmm. This is the paradox that faces the doctors. Do we hasten death? We don't want to do that. We don't want to prolong their suffering either. But you're trying to come out with a usable organ at the end of the whole process also.
Doesn't that affect the treatment of the dying too, because of the drugs you use?
Definitely.
Are stroke victims' organs good candidates?
Mm-hmm. Fairly young people do blow out blood vessels in their brain and die, and they're a good candidate.
I was told I lived in too small a town, it couldn't be.
That's right. You have to be close to a town. Like in Spokane now, we do harvest donors in Spokane. But it's probably Spokane and maybe Wenatchee and maybe in Seattle, in this state that is doing it.
And yet I know a neighbor of mine was taken to University of Minnesota, mm-hmm. 100 miles away.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's another moral issue. Do you want to, transport the patient from the smaller community to the larger community just for the purpose of organ transplantation?
Well, he died right there, but was taken anyway.
Oh, the organ was taken in the small community?
Mm-hmm. 25,000.
We live 120 miles from Iowa City, and they told us that at the time of our deaths, we should contact Iowa City immediately. They would send a hearse this way, and our mortician said, well, this way they'd meet us, and they would take our bodies.
Yeah.
But he said, don't let a local mortician touch you, because We embalm for a year, the local mortician for probably 5-6 days.
You're talking about harvesting mainly corneas.
Corneas and using the body for research.
And using the body for research. You're not talking about using an organ like the kidney for transplant. No.
Why is the Roman Church antagonistic? The business of the Temple of God not to be molested or...
I'm not sure. I'd let you read the book here. They talk about the issue as far as the Catholic Church is concerned right now.
He has something about, I don't understand this fully, but I know that we've had to deal with this, that when the body is buried, it has to be buried intact. All parts here, so there are times when it's safe. But I wanted to ask you a question about the point of death. And I feel that the Quinlan people in the book did not sufficiently define death. And I feel that the doctors are kind of left on a branch, standing out there by themselves. And I know that, like in Minneapolis, there is a group of lawyers and doctors together who are trying to challenge the court. Right now in the court system, there's a case of that 8-year-old child that was battered. And she was sustained by a respirator, but the death certificate was sent in by the doctor. And it was accepted by the courts, and it's now in the court system. And it was just purely done so that it could be defined by the legal system.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to define it somehow.
Yeah, I know. I really have a feeling that we still have not defined where death occurs. And with all of these implications at this point, it doesn't seem reasonable to me. Karen?
To the topic of family donors, when you mentioned that parents can sign for the question of whether or not parents can sign for minor children to donate to each other, up to what age are parents allowed to do this?
They were talking about the case of 2 7-year-old twins in the book here.
There was one publicized in the newspapers not too long ago, perhaps about that age.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what. This raises a lot of questions.
What kind of arrangements does the government make with people who have home dialysis, for instance, a rancher's wife in a remote rural area has one in the basement of the home that runs 3 times a week, and her husband has, and they have a direct line to Mayo Clinic that they can call if any malfunction occurs. On what basis would a person like that be eligible for the machine, and what kind of financial, or is there no financial arrangement?
Well, yeah. If you've got the money to pay for it, you can pay for it yourself.
They pay the government for the lease of that machine. Is that
a... They can buy their own machines. I think the machines themselves now are running for about $20,000 to $40,000 a home dialysis machine. It's not the dialysis machine so much that's expensive. It's all of the chemicals and everything that you have to go with it. And this can run up to easily $100,000 a year, I've been told, for maintaining a person on home dialysis at home. But this is still cheaper than bringing that person to, say, a university center for dialysis on a regular basis every so often.
She flies to Rochester every 3 times a year.
Does she? Yeah.
Yeah.
For a little tune-up job.
Yeah.
You know, some kind of thing. Yeah.
Check.
Well, I don't know what the view of the Catholic Church is on this, but our local Catholic priest at home is on a machine twice a week, and he's carrying on his regular work in the parish. Mm-hmm. And first one kidney failed, and then he had a heart attack, and then the other kidney failed. And he's been on that for, I suppose, a year now.
Yeah, they don't object to the use of dialysis, but there's some objection apparently to transplantation, to the giving of organs of your body and perhaps receiving somebody else's. I don't know. I don't understand the implications of that.
Is there an upper age physical condition limit to a donor? Everyone that dies is not usable.
Right, especially not for kidneys. But I think that you can be quite old and give your corneas, for instance, mm-hmm. for use.
But the kidneys tend to wear out.
Yes, yeah. Kidneys, we're talking about the kidneys somewhat over 2 years now, cadaver kidneys. I was talking to a doctor this morning who lives in the Seattle area and has a patient who's had two kidneys. Two cadaver kidneys. Received one, lasted 2 years, and then that failed, and received another one. So.
Was it a rejection problem?
Yeah, it's usually a rejection problem after the period of time. We still have not completely solved all of that problem. We can retard it, but we can't wipe it out completely. And so over a period of time, your kidney gradually loses function.
Did I understand you correctly? I have a friend that had kidney transplant. Now, does she have to look forward to having it done again quite often?
No. Well, they're getting longer and longer with them, and it depends on the tissue match. There are a number of factors that all come into it. What her original problem was. You know, if she had quite severe hypertension at the time when she received her kidneys and was not well controlled, that would shorten the life of the kidney. And there are a number of factors which all have a bearing on how long that kidney will last a person. But you don't receive, at this time, particular time, you don't receive a kidney, and that's going to last you the rest of your natural life. It's going to last you a variable period of time, and then you face the problem of gradually going back to the stage where you have to be re-dialyzed again to assume some more of the function, then finally you get to the point where you are again a candidate for another transplant. So, you know, we're not curing these 1,000 people who are getting kidneys every year are not cured for life, and so we face another 1,000 the next year. They keep coming back to haunt us right at this particular point.
I'd like to ask a question, then make a comment about it. I don't know the answer to this, but when a person dies, may you, as an MD, without consent of anyone, order an autopsy?
No, I can't.
It must have consent of whom?
Must have consent of the immediate relatives.
What if there's a suspicion that there's been some sort of irregularity in the death?
Then the coroner has the right to order an autopsy.
I didn't know how it was done, but obviously there has to be a way in which an autopsy can be done without the consent of the owner of the body, who is, of course, the family.
Mm-hmm.
That's a person who no longer owns his body after death, obviously. Now, if that's true in case of an autopsy, for rather limited social purposes, the suspicion of murder or poisoning or whatever it may be, don't we have an awfully good analogy already for saying that society has a perfectly legitimate basis for removing from the relatives the ownership of this particular piece of property, i.e. a cadaver? And haven't we already breached that question? Simply a matter now of extending it to saying that there's as much social utility in keeping somebody else alive as there is in trying to have suspicion that somebody did somebody else in.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the question answers itself, but it seems to me we already have pretty good analogy.
The terminology that you use in harvesting organs is one that I notice a number of people demonstrate some repulsion over, but it's a neat term. A portion of your body is harvested to be used, you know, by others. I don't know why it would be so difficult to develop that kind of mentality over against the one we've got now of being buried whole or something like that. I suppose they save an amputated arm, you know, to bury you whole later or something.
I was thinking, listening to all this, that perhaps there's a way in which in our churches we can do something in the area of stewardship, body stewardship. Of course, we talk about it oftentimes. While we're living, are we stewards of our body, giving it all the help we can, or meeting conditions for health? Shouldn't there be something we can do under the Lordship of Christ whereby we sense that we are stewards not only of ourselves but also of every other person, so that somehow we can sign up our people to, or get them to sign up, whereby they give their bodies? I don't know how this would work out, but it sounds like a very important factor.
I'd like to piggyback his comment with an observation that if any community needs to wrestle with the moral dimensions of those kinds of decisions, it is the church. And if that's the case, it seems to me that the question becomes not when is the moment of death, but when does life end? And I think that's a fundamentally different question there.
It is, Dave.
And I think that's a question the church can wrestle with. And I think we have some models, you know, in New Testament literature, you know, to give us some help in dealing with that issue. But I like the idea, you know, of stewardship and the whole idea that the church needs to have an educational focus instead of an isolated study group here and there. It seems to me the church could make a powerful witness to Congress or to whoever else that's legislating those kinds of decisions, that deals not with expediency, which is, I think, primarily what those who move into apartments across the street from hospitals, you know, are looking at. They're not looking at moral questions, I don't think. When you're in the midst of a crisis, a life and death crisis, you don't often consider the moral dimension. And I think when you're in a dispassionate moment of study and looking at the options, then you can take a more critical look at that dimension. I think the church ought to be about that, but perhaps on a more concentrated basis.
But then again, I wonder, why are we white Americans of such value that we can, you know, spend this amount of money and talk about stewardship to preserve the life of Americans when there's other people in the world who don't even have, you know, a chance at life?
$35,000 for 2 years, or $50,000.
Yeah, that's the question.
And that's the immediate cost of just the transplant. That isn't.
I went to 50.
That doesn't surround all of the care around it.
The question that would tie in with this: if the money wasn't spent that way, could it be transferred into another area, which seldom happens?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Collins, on the transplant of kidneys, for example, in young children, what happens to the growth factor because they have not reached physical maturity, physical development? Does the growth usually continue in the transplant organ? Or?
Yes, yeah. Usually, most of the time in children, unless you're receiving your organ from, say, another twin, you're talking about a large adult-sized organ being transplanted into a child, okay? So that's the more common thing. But with a child that, say, receives a twin organ, then the organ will grow.
Provided there's no rejection.
Right, providing no rejection takes place. You get your best tissue match, of course, from a twin.
Do they usually try up to a certain point, say, between the age of 5 and 45 or whatever, they try to match an age bracket also, or is that...
Well, this involves how the severity of the disease and whatever stage your child is when he reaches what we call end-stage renal disease, where medically we've done everything possible for him, and now it becomes a surgical problem. Either you're facing death or transplantation. And that can, you know... Usually, with younger children, it's been my experience that you usually don't transplant, because they're facing a long life of needs for retransplantation and further medical care.
When a person wants to donate a twin for a twin, what kind of facts are we given to that person? Like, is it very chancy that my twin brother with my organ, or vice versa, I don't have a twin, I'm pretending, would live only 2 years on my kidney?
Yes.
Are they told that?
Yes, that's one of the hard facts. That for the donor, the process of extracting the kidney from him is, there's very little to no risk at all from that particular procedure, so he doesn't suffer a great physical loss or the chance of a great physical loss. But there are a lot of implications of who he gives the kidney to. You know, I mean, if it's a brother, a twin, and the length of period or the period of time that kidney may last the brother, and the guilt feelings that may go along with that, you know, of you know, my organ wasn't good enough for him, or you know.
You say that sometimes doctors, when you sense a little bit of confusion about the donor giving a kidney, the doctor will say there isn't a good kidney match. Is the donor aware of that? For the
right.
Potential donor?
Yes.
I mean...
But what the doctor is doing is just allowing the individual, if they want an excuse to get out of giving their organ. Then he tells everybody concerned that the tissue match is so poor that they don't want that organ.
Yeah, but that doesn't help him deal with when his brother dies.
No.
He has to think, I could have prolonged it.
That's right.
If he didn't know the truth about that, it would give him an excuse. But this way, it's just everybody else's excuse.
Mm-hmm.
The pressure must be terrible on the kid. If he's 5 or 6 and they ask him, what can he say?
even if he doesn't want to be emotional. Ooh, that must be frightening.
I'd like to tack on that point, because that's when you were speaking about it originally, it occurred to me that that is in itself a very problematic moral problem, to shelter a person from the realities of his decision by saying, look, you are not going to have to struggle with the question of the opinion of the rest of your family and the rest of society in reaching a decision whether to donate or not. I think that's got real moral problems with it. We don't make decisions in life being insulated from the realities of our decisions. And I think that's the reason why it's particularly significant to insulate those who are incapable of making fully informed decisions. Children, mm-hmm. people of limited mental capacity, where it's unfair to impose upon them that kind of a question. But with a person that we would be willing to classify as a rational, mature person, to say to that person, I'll give you an easy out by telling the rest of the world that your match is so bad that you're not an eligible donor, I think is a very serious moral issue in that, and that kind of distortion of reality.
Mm-hmm.
What other organs are used in transplant?
Well,
eyes.
But mainly just the cornea of the eye. And this is a tremendous service, just the cornea, because I've known several patients who that cornea made all the difference in the world, you know, of being able to see and not to see.
Well, is that a real expensive operation?
No, it isn't. It's not a very expensive thing at all. You're talking $1,000 to $2,000 maybe. And that's as a long-lasting thing, and I've had one patient who had to go through it twice over about a 20-year period of time, so it is relatively long-lasting. But the other organs that we're presently are using is the liver transplant right now. It's being done in the Denver area, and this is still a very much an experimental model. Many children are born with congenital abnormalities of the liver such that they can't sustain life, and there's a fairly successful program going on down there for liver transplants right now. Still very experimental, but they're giving these children years now. And then, of course, the heart transplant, with, I think, the last heart transplant taking place 2 years ago, maybe, or so.
You don't include blood.
It's kind of almost like a medicine that I use every day, you know, but it is technically a transplant.
Yes, a transplant. It seems to me, again, you've got an awful good analogy.
Yeah.
Are there any machines to supplement the liver, replace it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. This is the way, probably the where technology is going to go in the next few years, is by replacing organs with machines. Right now, in the very near future, we may have artificial pancreases for people with diabetes. Looks very promising, and people with diabetes will undergo a surgical procedure in which an artificial pancreas will be implanted in the body, and it will meter out the amount of insulin into their bloodstream that they need to maintain their function. And there are possibilities for other, or the heart, there's tremendous. I trained at Baylor and was there during the whole period of time when the organ transplantation was really going great between DeBakey and Cooley and everybody, and there's a lot of research going there, and they have a lot of experimental models of pumps that can now be placed within the body. The only problem is that you're connected to a line of some kind, whether it be electrical or air-driven or whatever. But that is something in the future. And it's possible that the kidney will be replaced one day by a technology, some kind of machine. Mark?
Is it possible that a lot of the ethical and moral and legal questions are simply after the fact, because inventors are inventing machines that make new medical technology possible, And instead of saying, we will not invent in this area or we will not do that, we go along because somebody invented something, mm-hmm. and then afterwards deal with the implications of the invention.
Well, I think we always are doing that, at least in my experience in medicine. I mean, we develop the technology long before anybody ever thinks about the moral implications from it. And it's after the technology proves out and first begins being used on a fairly regular basis that then we start facing the reality of the moral issues that are implicated.
And are there companies that are just in the business of encouraging medical inventions?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
It seems pretty strange to me that medical technology is always inventing new things. Why don't we try to solve some of the problems we have right now in medical areas? I mean, like, you know, sudden infant death syndrome and cerebral palsy, and I mean, there's a whole realm of things that we could spend our money on, but we don't. We invent, and then we don't even try to solve the problems we have.
No, there is active research going on in all of those particular areas now. Unfortunately, they haven't been too fruitful, and it doesn't look too promising at this particular point, but all of medical problems of man are being investigated and studied.
I was interested in this gentleman's question about the different kinds of transplants that are going on, like the cornea, and then what others besides the heart and the kidney and so forth.
Basically, that's it at this particular point. Unless you're talking about skin transplants, of course. Hair transplants.
I was commenting on one thing that Vern was doing about the moral problem with the donor. And one of the things that happened this spring was it was one of the eastern cities anyway, that his second cousin or something like that was asked to be a donor for the bone marrow transplant, which is still in the experimental stage. And he refused because he said that he didn't think that the risk to him was worth, you know, the very small chance of his second cousin having a successful transplant. And what happened to that person was basically horrible, and the press got a hold of this, and he was just run up and down every paper across the country for being a terrible person because he refused to be a donor. And what is society's responsibility to somebody who says, no, I do not want to be a donor, even though the risk is small, I just don't want to accept that risk. And where does society say, well, you have to accept that risk in order to save this other person's life? And there was a lot of discussion about whether if there had been a court injunction saying you have to do this, whether he could have then sued back and said that this is a violation of my person, and they could be charged with assault and battery for actually doing this. I'm wondering if maybe Vern could comment on that and other people too. Just what is the, you know, what happens when the donor says no?
Surely he does have the right to refuse, and the penalty is the same penalty as where I refuse to give money to feed somebody to starve. Under our law, whether it's right or wrong, you know, we've made the decision that we are independent persons. We get to make these decisions. You can't demand my money except by tax. Some process and you decide to regularize. That's why I was interested in the autopsy question. You know, we have legal processes for taking things from people.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way we do it. Without that kind of regularity, the answer is you don't have to. The law of almost every state in the United States today, if you see a child lying face down in a little puddle of water drowning, you have no obligation to pick up that child. Now, legally, you walk right by the door if you like. That's because you're an individual, you make your own decisions. See? The law of most of Europe is the contrary. You have a positive duty to rescue. And that's why, legally at least, it's possible for a state like Sweden with the notion of duty, legal duty, I'm not talking about morality, I'm talk about legal duty. A duty to rescue, that's why Sweden will put in active capture. It says it's your duty to make the organs available. Blood, arteries, tissue. You don't have any right to say no to society. Then you get the underlying question of, do you want to belong to society or do you want to belong to you? And that's not so easy to answer, especially not when you think about the way that we govern ourselves occasionally. I'm not so sure that I want the tax collectors coming around taking my left leg and falling my as well as X percent of my income. That's a difficult question to answer. I don't mean to be flippant about that.
How did Sweden come to this position? Could it possibly have been by the influence of the church, which is nil?
I think at an earlier stage it might very well have been. It's a different concept, you see, about who you are and to whom you belong and so forth. I think in one way we are misposing our issue here and even talking about death. I don't know where you people are theologically, and I'm no theologian. At least I have no degree in that area. I like to think about it, but I think it's not very helpful to think about a person being dead. I don't believe that I will ever be dead. My body is going to go through all kinds of transformations, but I think I will continue to live. Mm-hmm. I think I go from life to life. And now comes the question of when I'm no longer one of my left leg, as far as I'm concerned, you're welcome to it. And I would hope that my relatives wouldn't feel any great proprietary interest in it. And that's why it's just another piece of tissue, as far as I'm concerned, when I'm out there. I think death is a process. And to say that a person is dead at a given instant is misleading. I think the person, doctor, would know much better than I, but I suspect that death is a process that occupies a period of at least hours and maybe days, for all I know. That didn't used to be a tough problem legally, because most of the questions that we had to answer legally, if you weren't sure, why wait a couple days, and you could probably not answer the question. The question now is one of speed, and I think now we have to decide when a person is eligible for a transplant. I don't even like to think of it as being when is he dead for a transplant, but when is the person eligible for transplanting, and that may very well be when there's still breath or still a pulse or something else, because at that stage in the process it becomes appropriate to relieve that person of, for example, a kidney.
I can remember one of the things that happened when I was at Baylor was that a young robber, or was it a robber? No, it was a young man had been shot in the head by another person and had a massive head injury, was going to die, and his body was donated for transplant, for a heart transplant at that particular point. And when the person who had shot him was brought up in the courts, his lawyer claimed that the doctors had killed the young man. It wasn't him that had done it. They had, of course, taken his heart out. Therefore, he was dead, and he wasn't really dead because of the massive brain injury that he had.
That's why that needs to be defined. Of course, that happened in California with a young girl that was hit by a drunken driver, and the drunken driver was brought to court. The lawyer tried to get him sentenced taken away because they felt that the murderer was a doctor who took the heart from the child, the 14-year-old girl, who had been declared brain dead.
It seems to me that the discussion that we're having is something that captures our imaginations because it's close to where most of us live, I suppose. We think in terms of, you know, maybe that could happen to us. Maybe that happens in our families, and no one knows how much money we'd be willing to spend in order to have that organ that would mean life or whatever. And back there was a comment about, you know, maybe the church could make a real good stewardship statement by encouraging people to be donors of organs and so on. that's still kind of a self-serving thing in a sense, because it's middle-class people serving middle-class people and so on. It seems to me that the church could make a stronger statement by being a part of a matter of prioritizing and saying, you know, is it ethical to spend $100,000 to preserve one life when, you know, there is a terrific imbalance in Global Village? That's a bigger question than we need to deal with.
I agree.
You know, and that we can spend all kinds of time in this kind of discussion, and we like it because we're all middle-class people. But it's bigger than that.
Like that sign in the cafeteria, live simply so others can simply live.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I think that can be oversimplified too. The solution to our organ transplant problems, with all of the attending costs, is at this point an unsolvable dilemma. And it's the same way with all the food around the world. No. I'm not trying to be naive about that, but also let's not try to be naive about the... This is God's work. You know, there is a tremendous skill and science involved there. And in a way, it's another human life, and you also want to say, hang the cost. And, but you got to say, hang the cost on the other side, too. I can't see it as either or. No way is it either or. It's got to be somehow both and, without always hurling judgments in one place or another that, oh, God, we spend so much money on science. We have to deal with those judgments, but I can't go with either or.
And what's wrong with going to heaven?
I don't like that. No, we still have life to sustain. I'm going to live as long as I can.
See, I don't know what we would do. Our daughter has one kidney. And if that kidney would go bad, you know, I don't know what we would do. Tell you the truth.
Sure. And some guy said, you got to send the money to Africa to feed them over there instead of your kid's kidney. Mm-hmm.
Once you get involved emotionally, it's difficult to think in the way we're thinking this morning, for example.
Very unemotional.
I'm here sitting listening to you talk about twins giving donors and everything. I hope I never come to that decision, because I haven't heard any of you make a statement of what I should do. If one of my children's kidneys went out, I had to choose which one would give to that one. I just hope I never have to decide. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what it would be.
That's why I think Bernie's comments are so relevant from at least the perspective that I look at this. I don't think the decision can be made by somebody else, and I don't think that we can ignore our responsibility as Christian people. We have to think of these things, period. It isn't something that you can lock up in a closet and forget about. You do have a responsibility, and when I say that, I mean you. I don't mean the group. I think you have a responsibility. And you have to resolve that. And one person will make an entirely different decision from somebody else, and that's perfectly legitimate.
The guy that wrote the book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, now he's roaring around the country becoming very disillusioned with science, because what he finally has decided is that every solution science comes up with, there are like 100 new problems. And I think he kind of cops out on science and goes with some other kind of philosophy. But we either quit it, you know, and give up all this scientific exploration, or be prepared to deal with the new problems that each solution creates. You know, there are an awful lot of moral problems besides the attending scientific ones.
Mm-hmm.
I always wonder what happens if science and medical staff quit, you know, and stop. I don't know we would stop that. I mean, it seems like we could use that money into other sources.
Are you saying you don't think that society would be affected if we had no doctors and nurses and hospitals and...
No, I think society... I'm saying that we could stop the science and not try to invent new things and stuff. And this, you know, let it be, and I don't know, I think we are advanced enough that we can survive on what we have.
I don't think
that really doesn't depend. If you think of what's happening with cancer, think of how many different forms of cancer and how many more people just in this country are developing cancer daily. And we've had more and more research, and yet there's more and more and more of it.
So we would probably kill ourselves off.
Maybe that's the solution, but I don't think would help.
Carol?
Somebody asked about all the things that were transplantable. Last summer, I remember I heard on the radio that some team someplace had successfully transplanted the first testicle. And I worried for several weeks about whose kid that would be.
Be a high turner.
It seems to me that we can look at our body as a tent that we are simply using for a while, and when we go in the wilderness, we use our tent for protecting us and for enjoying being out in the wilderness. And now we are just using our tents here on earth, and it can be used for somebody else to protect them in the wilderness as we go on. And that it isn't really us.
What concerns me about the discussion of science is that we somehow are talking about God and the church and the science over here, and there's no relation between the two of them. And I read this book on healing by Bill Nolan, and you may not agree with everything he says, but one thing he did say he believed was that God does perform miracles and he does heal, but mainly he does it through the science and medicine of today, that came through God's leading.
I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
It always interests me that we use the word healing when we're talking theologically and curing.
It's all one. Mm-hmm. The whole thing. But it seems like we talk about healers, like theological and so-called faith realm. But you don't refer to doctors as healers.
Yeah.
When it says he healeth all of our diseases, it simply means that all diseases are healed by God. Period. End of the quote. I had a Catholic once with a doctor who flipped out of his brain when he finally came to realize he wasn't the healer. He had thought he was. Strange thing.
If you're in the medical profession, you find out in a hurry that you can do the same thing for 10 different patients, but they're going to get well by themselves in various stages, and no matter what you do to try to do it all the same, it never turns out that way. It's God's will that somebody gets well in a week. It's God's will that somebody stays ill long enough to learn lessons from him. This is something that the medical profession has no control over.
Carol's point back here a moment ago about who is who after you've transplanted enough reminds me of a story that was told to me by a friend of mine in Seattle. He had been trying to persuade his father to put on a hearing aid. His father had some difficulty hearing, and he was correctable, but his father would not wear a hearing aid, and finally Leo braced him on the subject. He said, "Dad, you're being silly about this. You can hear." His father said, "Look, son," he said, "I get up in the morning, I put on my hair," and he wore it today, "I put in my teeth, I put on my glasses, I put on my truss, I put on my leg." He had a pacer for his heart, and he made some comment about that. He said, "And I'm not going to plug myself in."
I think we've kind of run dry on the subject, so we'll probably adjourn for lunch. It's been an interesting discussion. I don't think we solved all of the problems by any means, but maybe we jogged you to think a little bit about them.